The Hendrix family murders stand as a haunting and unresolved chapter in the annals of true crime, shrouded in mystery and contention. The tragic events date back to November 7, 1983, when the Hendrix family met a horrific fate in Bloomington, leaving an indelible mark on the community and sparking a decades-long quest for answers. The gruesome quadruple homicide involving David Hendrix's wife and three children sent shockwaves through the nation and left investigators grappling with a puzzle. Despite the passage of over four decades, the case remains enshrouded with lingering questions surrounding motives, evidence, and potential suspects. Amidst the fervent pursuit of justice, the case has been the subject of intense scrutiny, spawning a plethora of theories, investigations, and legal battles. The persistent efforts to unravel the truth behind the Hendrix family murders have reverberated through various platforms, including podcasts, documentaries, and legal discourse, underscoring the enduring impact of this saga. As the years have unfolded, the quest for closure and accountability in this chilling tale has continued to grip the public imagination, fueling ongoing discussions and contemplation. The complex intricacies of the case, coupled with the enduring absence of definitive resolution, serve as a reminder of the unresolved mysteries that persist within the realm of criminal justice. But is it really unresolved? What if the authorities got it right? We will examine all the evidence in this case and let you be the judge. All right, we're live.
Okay. All right.
Okay, here.
Okay, so this is my drink. So we've had the delicious poppies. Y'all are doing cans. I'm like, hey, let's do a can. Mm-hmm. So tell me what you think, and I'll tell you what it is.
Watermelon? You freaking... You're a jackass.
That's good.
I hate watermelon.
I know.
Did you know she hated watermelon?
And I was gonna bring the lavender, but I was out. So I'm like, I'm not gonna tell her there's watermelon. What do you think?
Pretty good.
It is good.
Not well, good?
Y'all enjoy if y'all want.
Watermelon what?
It's Sandia. Sandia.
Lena.
It is not that bad.
Y'all don't understand.
It's like licking your face.
It's trauma which from you childhood. Hate.
You've been
stand the
you got all
smell.
Kinds
what
of work
was the
you've
trauma
done.
With
you should
the
be able
watermelon.
To have
apparently
watermelon.
I need to do that.
Yeah, obviously.
Can't do it.
But Sandia hard cider. And the lavender is the best.
I love lavender.
Eyes out.
You can not go.
Did you?
Let's just bring Elena the watermelon. Be fine.
You took a pretty big gulp.
You did.
That's how I do.
All right. So just to make sure you're healed from the trauma, a little sip just to give me
I
an
just
honest
did it.
Assessment.
No. I didn't know it was watermelon. And then I drank it and I'm about died.
No. Okay. First of all, you're being honest. A dramatic baby sister.
I can be dramatic. You just did
just now
watermelon to me.
Hey,
how could
I
you do that
grown
knowing
as a
she
person.
Hates it?
Well,
I will eat anything and drink anything of all things, Sherry.
So was that a bad big sister prank on
I
the little
sister? I just thought she was over a lot
you know?
Of stuff.
It's
so
Sherry
but
Wilson.
Anyway,
I'm shocked.
If I had liked it, you know I would have drank it.
Well, I don't know. Because there's obviously some trauma
really,
tied
really
to watermelon.
Don't like watermelon.
Jerry.
There's things you don't
what
like.
What a prank.
You've even like spit stuff
it
out.
Wasn't a prank. It was not a prank.
I think it's bullcrap.
I was hoping
I
she could
that.
Drink it and not have any problems is what I was genuinely
me
hoping.
Me too. I was looking forward to all beverages.
But there's Sauvignon Blanc in there. Might as well get
everything.
You some. Might as well get you some.
Good.
But we're now like 5 minutes into the trauma. So I want to introduce, okay? So my sister, who's obviously having a rough time. Go ahead.
Elena.
Mom.
Mom, Sherry, this is Outline of a Murder. Do you want to grab you some
Sauvignon? You want some wine? Go get you a little glass.
I would. No, genuinely, I was hoping you would like it.
Me too.
And I was hoping it wasn't going to be traumatic. No, I'm serious. It was not a prank. I was hoping she had gotten over things and she could have it. Okay. Okay, so this case.
Yes.
It's the Hendricks family murders. How did y'all think I did on the Scott Peterson as far as going by the court records?
Excellent. I like that.
I do too.
I'm sorry.
Because it's a lot of facts. Oh, wow.
Very good. Very good.
Mm.
You did a good job. I like that. Are you eating my chocolate?
Yeah.
Well, go ahead. Hell, I had watermelon eat my chocolate.
So this case is also from the court records.
I love that.
The reason I wanted to do this case is I actually heard True Crime Garage, my all-time favorite podcast. I've listened to every single episode.
I'm not even half done.
It took me over a year. But they did this case, and I, one day we're going to be at Crime Con, and I just have to say, if the captain ever listens to this episode, I disagree with his conclusions.
Oh, no.
And that's what made me dig in. I'm like, I'm sorry, Captain. I'm sorry, but you're wrong. So, yeah, he said it was pretty terrible. Is it worth being poured down the sink? Yeah. Okay.
The wine, I pour it, then we'll pour it later.
I will.
So the...
It's very grapefruity.
The time frame that we're in is in the 80s. And I believe the murders were in 1983. And it was the Hendricks family. So let me pull that up. There's not a lot of media for them, obviously, it being in the 80s. But this is the family here.
The 80s mustache.
I just listened to the podcast about them on True Crime Garage.
So what'd you think? Like what? And I know, I don't think you've ever heard of this, but basically the husband has been accused of murdering his family.
Okay.
So what do you think? Do you think he was innocent, guilty? Are you kind of on the fence?
I'm on the fence about it.
Okay.
They're pretty convincing.
They are very convincing, but me, I was not. Because I'm like, no, he did it. And when I dove into the court cases or the court documents, to me, there's even more proof, which I'll kind of highlight as we go. But during
that was a good one.
It was really good. So during the late evening hours of November 8th, 1983, police officers discovered the bodies of Susan, Rebecca, Grace, and Benjamin Hendricks. So Susan is the wife, and then you have Rebecca and Grace, I believe in order of age, and then you have Benjamin, the little kiddo, the little guy. All but Rebecca had sustained multiple injuries to the head, neck, and upper torso, causing near instantaneous death. Rebecca had sustained a single skull fracture. Police officers found the children's bodies in the southwest bedroom. Rebecca was in one bed. Grace and Benjamin were in the other, and the beds were about 22 inches apart, so less than 2 feet. Officers found Susan's body, the mom, in the master bedroom bed, with the bed clothing pulled down around her shoulders. None of the victims who were dressed in pajamas or nightgowns bore evidence of defensive wounds. So on December 5th, information issued alleging David Hendricks, the dad, knowingly or intentionally caused the victim's death. Susan was the defendant's wife. Rebecca, Grace, and Benjamin were his children. So we'll get into the details of the crime, but... Let me see if on this picture right here. Yeah, so multiple deaths probe. But I have this here so you can see the house. So it's a typical suburban type home. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was in a neighborhood versus a rural area. Okay. Defendant, David and his wife, Susan, they were married in 1973 after he received his associate's degree in orthotics and prosthetics, which is the study and fabrication of artificial body supports and limbs. They were also members of the Plymouth Brethren.
Didn't he invent something?
He did.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's the Plymouth Brethren?
They're a non-denominational religion. It's a Christian religion. There's a congregation where I live, and me and some friends used to do ministry in that church. So they're definitely like very conservative. They're conservative in their beliefs and also practices. So. Okay. They definitely have, yeah, they definitely have some religious tendencies, which you'd think, well, aren't they a religion? And what we mean by that is, like, you have some religions in Christianity where the woman can't wear makeup, she has to wear a dress, she has to have her hair up in a bun. Then you have other Christian aspects of, you know, the faith where women wear jeans and right. You raise your hands in worship. So I would say if you go to the Plymouth Brethren, they're definitely stricter, maybe is a better phrase. Mm-hmm. Now they lived in 1982. They moved to 313 Carl Drive in Bloomington, Illinois, and his practice prospered. He had developed and patented his own brace, mm-hmm. the cruciform anterior spinal hyperextension orthosis, or CASH for short. In November of 81, he sold the patient care and the fitting portion of the business to a man named Edward Roman, telling employees that he was selling that portion of the business so he could spend more time with his family. And then the offices of the patient care portion of the defendant's business was located a few blocks away from his home. And in his offices, he had the laboratory and the fitting rooms. So basically, the patient care, he sold that to Mr. Roman, and then he maintained the development of the braces, the fitting rooms, et cetera, as a business.
But he was a salesman, too. He traveled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he traveled quite a bit.
You know, like you do when you see pharmaceutical companies go into the doctor. Mm-hmm. He was doing that, too.
Yeah, and he was very successful. He was mm-hmm. very good at it. He seemed like he was very intelligent. He had keys to his office, obviously, and he used it for product development. So he started in 81. So let's see, he sells that November, and then he also starts a new business called CASH Manufacturing, which he then incorporated. And he had an office manager. Her name's Beverly Crutcher. Those were the principal's principal employees. So he was an employee. She was an employee. She testified that she processed orders for the brace, which was a mail order business, as well as, like you said, he would travel to sell mm-hmm. his braces. And she did secretarial and bookkeeping skills. On November 3rd of 1983, so that he started the business in 81 and sold the other part of it the same year. And then in 83... he told Mrs. Crutcher that he was going to make a sales trip to central Wisconsin and north central Illinois. I wonder if it's Bloomington, Indiana. Hang on. Let me make sure I didn't get that incorrect.
I didn't want anyone drinking after me.
Oh.
Just in case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Illinois. Yeah. Okay. I want to make sure I was correct. So he's going to go on this trip, and it sounds like he's going to make several stops on the trip. And she compiled, both he and Ms. Crutcher, compiled a list of prospective clients from telephone books. Remember back in the day?
Yes.
So for the little kiddies listening to the podcast, that was a thing. We had telephone numbers in telephone books.
And addresses and your names.
In telephone books.
But we still have telephone numbers.
I know, but they're not in telephone books.
Oh, I thought you said in and telephone books. Yeah. Yep.
And the addresses were there as well. So if you wanted to stalk someone, you could just, you know, look up their address in the telephone book.
Some people don't even know what a payphone is.
Right.
Younger people.
Yep. Or if they see one, they're like,
don't know how to use
it. Oh, how do you use this?
Yes.
Oh, that was my kids.
Do tell.
That was my kids up in Philadelphia. So Ms. Crutcher, they go through the telephone books, they have old client order forms, they put together this list, and then she gave it till Monday, November 7th, or on Friday, November 4th. On Monday, the defendant told her that he was going to leave at midnight and drive straight through, calling on customers in the morning. This was the only time she could remember him informing her specifically of his proposed departure time.
How long had she worked for him?
Let's see. 81 is when he started this aspect of his business. So for 2 years.
Okay. She'd know him pretty well.
Yep.
And there'd be a pattern, a routine. So, what do you think, Mom?
I don't know, but sometimes in the morning when if I go to the doctor, you'll see these salesmen come in early.
Yeah, that's not the question. The question is, what do you think about him
deviating from his routine?
Yeah. Nothing.
Very first time.
Nothing.
To me, it's a little bit of a red flag.
I mean, it's a little odd, but I don't know.
All we needed to know. You can stop.
I'd like
talking
to see
now.
What his reason was behind it.
Good point. Yeah.
He didn't give her a reason.
No, I'm stopping talking.
Nope, he didn't have a reason for telling her.
It's unusual. 2 years.
But then now, again, if you don't have a reason to tell, I wouldn't be suspicious, would you?
Yeah, the very first time ever.
But he did several times let her know that he was leaving at night. So that was actually, that was common. That sometimes he would leave after the kids were put in bed, maybe spend a little bit of time with the wifey and then leave. But he never told the secretary when for sure he was leaving.
Yeah.
So
maybe to
it's
get an alibi.
It's something to note, not necessarily evidence of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
So the defendant left the office that day at 4, and he had previously agreed to babysit the kids, which I don't see how a husband babysits because they're his kids as well, while Susan attended a baby shower in Delavan, is about 25 miles east or west of Bloomington. Defendant called the children in from playing at around 5:30 p.m. He stated that after he arrived home, he worked on his motorcycle for a little bit, readying it for winter storage. He then rode his motorcycle to his airplane hangar, and then he jogged home. Susan left between 5:30 and 6. Then the children and David went to a Chuck E. Cheese. Remember those?
Oh, yeah. They still have one somewhere.
Oh, they're around a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is crucial on the time frame. So they go to Chuck E. Cheese at 6:30. They ordered a medium vegetarian pizza and a pitcher of root beer. The pizza would have been built, baked, and ready for consumption within 10 to 15 minutes. A medium vegetarian pizza is cut into 10 slices, and then it has the cheese, the mushrooms, green pepper, olives, tomato, onions, and sauce. Mm-hmm. Now, they're really stressing that because of evidence later.
Yeah.
So if they get there at 6:30, they order their pizza, you're looking between, 6:40 and 7 o'clock when the pizza would be ready.
Yeah.
And, of course, they would probably start eating it pretty shortly after it arrives at the table, although they had lots of playthings for the kids to do because they probably wanted to eat it hot.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming they would have started eating and possibly even finished eating their pizza around 7 to 7:15 or so, if even that long.
Unless it's Mom, it's going to be at least 7:30 before it's finished.
8 o'clock, maybe.
Yeah, if Mom was eating the pizza, they would still be there.
Whatever. So you didn't even need Mom jokes. Y'all are just full of them today.
Wow.
I love it.
We are failing. We are failing. Did you pray to Jesus that we'd forget Mom jokes? Like, is Jesus working against us?
Maybe.
Anyway. Okay. So the restaurant has a play area. And again, this can be important too as far as digestion speed.
Yeah.
There was an air bounce pillow, rope slide, video games, rides, and a playhouse, and then a room filled with balls. The germs. Children who were under 4 feet 6 inches tall could enter the playland upon payment of 5 tokens, and then employees will stamp the children's hands with cartoon characters once they've paid the admission price. Why are you laughing?
Your terminology about children paying the currency of court documents. I know.
It's not my language.
The currency of five tokens. And they may enter the premises.
They may enter the premises to play on the playground with the various instruments of balls, rope slide,
etc. sentence, for God's sake. Go ahead. Continue.
The defendant provides the only testimony about his and the children's activities on November 7th. So they entered the playland vigorously using the equipment.
What is she doing? Her shoulders. She's like throwing them around on every word.
She can't talk like that without the movement.
Oh my goodness. So Mr. Henderson, he watched them play. I changed the language.
He watched the children play
actually
vigorously.
They said observed them.
Oh, good Lord. Go ahead.
So, wow, the bird.
She's gotten a lot of compliments on that. I've
got a lot of compliments.
And from strangers, because you know all the strangers that enter the land.
Yeah.
Okay, so here it says that they're playing, he's watching television, and then he got the pizza at 7.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He remembered thinking that it took a long time for the pizza to break, which it kind of is. I mean, if they got there at like 6:30, it only takes 10 to 15 minutes, but were they busy?
Depends how busy.
And the day.
Mm-hmm. So that was Monday. No. Yeah. No, I think it was Monday. I don't think they'd be that busy. Then they ate between 7 and 7:15 p.m. Mr. Henderson ate one piece. The children drank or ate the rest. So that was what?
Kind of
nine
kids.
Pieces in, you know, so probably three each. They also had that, and they drank the root beer. They ate very quickly, and then they returned to playing, which I could see that. Mm-hmm. They're going to want to shove it down and get to the play stuff.
That's a lot to eat and drink and then go play.
Hold on. Let's go back to this pizza situation because you know it's food.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying it's a medium pizza cut in
10 slices.
That's not very big.
No, but here's what I'm thinking. Like, a medium pizza now is cut into what, like 6 slices portions?
Oh, so it really could have been a large, but it's a medium. Mm. More pieces, right?
I was thinking it was smaller, but cut smaller. I'm sorry. I was just bunny trailing about the food portions and the food.
You do like your food.
Mm-hmm. And portions.
So he let them go to the play area, and then he left Chuck E. Cheese and went and filled up his car.
Now, this was in the 80s.
It was. Mm-hmm. And so he returned to the Chuck E. Cheese's at 7:50, so it took him about 20 minutes.
Wow.
I'm just, even back in the 80s, I was cautious as a kid. As a kid, I wouldn't want my parent to leave me by myself, even if I was with siblings. But I could see them doing that back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
All the kids are playing.
They're all playing.
I would have been mad as the Chuck E. Cheese's. Like, don't leave your kids here. But I remember when I was a kid, they started putting signs up in places. Don't leave your children unattended. Well, that's because of people like this guy. You know, they're going and running errands while the kids are playing.
And there's other parents there, so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he then rushed the children out to the car, he said. And then they rushed to the bookmobile located at Carl Drive and Wellington Way because the children wanted to have time to select their books because they closed between 8:15 and 8:30. So they wanted to hurry up and get there and let them have time to decide the books they want. And I could see that taking a bit with kids, mm-hmm. you know, because they'd have to look at them and the pictures and all that.
I love that they were rushing to get them books.
Then they played two rounds of hide and seek for 20 minutes before going to bed at between 9 and 9:30. The defendant said that he read to them for about 15 to 30 minutes, and the bookmobile attendant said that they left there about 8:10 to 8:15. Then Susan came home about 10:30. She then talked with David, her husband, for about 20 minutes, and then he left. Now, that's important. So we got to keep in mind they ate between 7 and 7:15. Mm-hmm. They're put in bed between 9 and 9:30. And then he says that she returned at 10:30 and they talked for about 20 minutes and he left, which would put him leaving at 10:50, not midnight.
With no sleep.
Like he told the secretary that he was going to leave at midnight.
I thought he laid down and slept for a bit, 30 minutes or so. No?
Nope.
Okay.
So I'm now seeing discrepancies. I want to know, number one, why he told the secretary he's going to leave at midnight when he had never told her when he was going to leave. Now, again, people aren't made in stone, you know, so he could definitely have a variation there. But then he leaves at 10:50 instead of midnight. It's not evidence of guilt, but it's a little bit weird. It's one of those things where I just kind of pause and be like, okay, that's a little bit strange to me. So I could see him thinking, well, she's here, I'm going to leave early.
Yep.
I'm going to get a head start on the road. Mm-hmm. And instead of midnight, I'm going to leave a little bit early. But things get a little bit muddled later as well.
Okay.
So he said that it was 11 p.m. or shortly thereafter that he left. So he admitted that to the cops later, that it was not 10:50. It was a little bit after 11. And he said that Susan didn't arrive home until 10:45 and that he talked with her for an hour. So now we have his story changing. What was it, Mr. Henderson or Hendricks? Hendricks? When? I've been calling him Henderson the whole time. Which is it? Did she come home at 10:30 or later? Did she talk for 20 minutes or an hour? Which one is it, Mr. Hendricks?
I don't know that it's that big of a discrepancy, though.
Anyway, Rodney Blair, foster son of Robert and Debbie Phillips, they were the next door neighbors, testified that soon after 9, he walked outside to Jeffrey Monahan's truck, which was parked in the driveway. I have no idea who Jeffrey is. And that he saw the defendant in his car backing out of the driveway onto Carl Drive. So this is soon after 9 p.m. Why is he backing out? He said that the defendant was alone in the car, that he then proceeded north, turned onto Wellington Way. Jeffrey corroborated Blair's statement, and then during cross-examination, Mr. Hendricks denied that he ever left the house near or at 9 p.m. So I don't know. I don't know if that matters. I don't know if it's a big deal that he left after he put the kids down. Was he going to run a short errand? Did he go to a convenience store? All I know what is strange is that he's saying he did not leave. They're saying they saw him leave. Any thoughts?
As to why?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it depends how they were killed.
That's true. That's true. So we do know that Susan left the baby shower at 9:40. Her mother testified that Susan took a snack plate with raw vegetables, cheese, and crackers, and that she ate 2 cookies as she was leaving the party. So obviously a fast eater.
Unlike me.
Test drives resulted in a total trip time of 52 minutes and 51 seconds. So these place her at approximately 10:33 at the house. Now, so he leaves. The kids are, you know, and the wife are at home supposedly sleeping. On November 8th, the next day, he made a series of sales calls in Wisconsin. All of them were with prospective customers. Agreed that cold calls, sell calls without appointments, they're pretty common. So I guess the question was raised, well, wouldn't he have made all these appointments before going to the different places? And the answer is no, because...
cold calls.
Yeah, they're going to call up, hey, I'm in town. It's almost like a pressure tactic where people don't want to be rude. So they're like, absolutely, come by. Let's talk about this. Versus if you make the appointments, a lot of them like, I'm busy, blah, blah. We used to do this. It annoyed my former employer at the jewelry store because they would just show up and she would hate it.
Yep.
And so typically she would say no.
Yep.
Because of that. She wanted them to call. But what was humorous is they would call her and she'd be like, no, I'm busy.
Right.
So it really depended on who it was. If she liked the jewelry, absolutely. It didn't matter. They cold called, she'd send them over. If they made an appointment, she'd make the appointment. But some of them that she didn't know or they kept switching her sales reps, I don't have time to meet. So he did the cold calls. He showed up. Several of the Brays purchased, you know, some of the product. What was interesting, though, is the defendant did not bring either model of his brace with him on the sales calls, stating he didn't have it.
That's weird. But he still got the clients?
A few of them. That's a subsequent weird. Search of his car revealed that he had both models of the brace with him.
Okay.
Why? Why didn't he bring them in? If he is going on sales calls... why would you say you don't have the brace with you? Why would you not take the brace in? Isn't that strange?
Lazy? No. Want to get the day over with? I don't know.
I don't know. He told two customers that he was on an extended vacation and wanted to see people who were using or going to use his brace. But he told his secretary that this was a sales trip. So I don't know. It's just weird that he would not take the braces in with him when he was discussing that product.
He was just setting up an alibi.
That's what I'm wondering.
I'm thinking, I'm just going to go there, tell him this, tell him that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you are serious selling something, you're going to have your product.
Yeah.
And put that leg brace on them. I mean, like,
it was a back brace, but yeah, yes.
Whatever. You're going to put it on. So if you want to make a sale, you're going to have your product.
Yeah.
He's trying to cover up. I mean, I just stepped in, but.
This is Susan, by the way, guys.
Best friend.
Best friend, yeah. Susan.
I second mean, mom.
That's yeah. what it sounds like, is he's setting up.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you sell makeup, you showing up without your makeup?
Exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's weird.
No, he's, okay. No.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry. Alibi.
Nope. Nope.
You're good.
It's all right.
You're good.
I'm thinking
excellent.
Alibi. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
Now, one of the guys that he was a big customer of his braces said that he came between 1 and 1:30. He was a major distributor of the cash product. And he said that the defendant had mentioned that he had been driving all night and that he usually stayed up all night once every week. I don't know why that's important, but he said it was. At trial, he testified, the defendant, that he left home at 11 p.m. or shortly afterwards, that he made three stops en route, each for no more than 15 minutes. First, he stopped at a restaurant for coffee to go, and then he took Route 51 north. His next stop was at a restaurant south of Rockford, Illinois. The defendant could not recall the name of the town or the restaurant. He then stopped at a rest area on I-90 or North 51, where he changed clothes. At approximately 7 a.m., he arrived at Stevens Point, Wisconsin, where he stopped at a Hardee's restaurant and ate breakfast. A time receipt from the Hardee's showed defendant did place an order at 7:17 a.m. He then called his secretary, Ms. Crutcher, at 8:30 at the office, which he usually did do when he was on a trip, so there was nothing weird about that. Then at 3 p.m., he called home. Approximately 1 hour later, he called Ms. Crutcher at work, and he asked Crutcher to call Susan for him because he had called twice and he had been unable to reach her. Crutcher placed three calls to the residence. The party stipulated to the accuracy of the telephone records that did happen, and the records do show that he called his residence at 3:01, 5:31, and 5:33, but none of the calls were answered.
I have to say, and I think unless it's just part of his routine, he's, you know, handling business during business hours, but you call your secretary and not your wife that morning.
Well, no, I think, so at 3 p.m., they called the secretary to let him know that he was on the trip.
Yeah.
But that seems to be something he normally did.
Yeah. No, the calling the secretary normally did fine, but I'm wondering if he usually called
the wife
in the morning
to let her know that he was safe, that he was doing his.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point. If he normally called his wife in the morning, which I have no evidence to say whether he did or not, but I would think that would be something he would do. He would call his secretary. He would call his wife to let her know he was safe and sound. He was doing his work. But he didn't. He called her at 3 in the afternoon.
It reminded me of the Peterson thing.
Yeah.
Those calls. Hey, can you call this person? Can't get a hold
of
her.
Yeah, calling the secretary.
Which is very common. It's very common. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we don't know. Maybe he didn't want to wake up her and the kids. You know, I don't know. But that's a good point.
Am I purple?
Fingertips.
Yeah.
makeup.
So at 5:35 p.m., Mr. Hendricks called Crutcher's residence, but reached her sister instead. At 5:38, he called Nathan and Mary Ann Palmer, who were in Delavan. The Palmers were his brother and sister-in-law. And they had invited he and his family to dinner with other family members later that night, that day. The defendant asked Marianne if Susan was there. So basically, it's like, we're supposed to go to eat dinner, or they're supposed to go to eat dinner with them. Is she there? Is that why I can't get a hold of her? And they said no, that she wasn't there. So he gave Marianne his house phone number, and he asked that she have Susan call. In other words, or he gave Marianne his number and then asked her to go over and see if Susan's okay. So he was, you know, told her, there's probably nothing wrong. You know, please call me within the next 30 minutes. Let me know if anything's going on, if she's not arrived. Basically, let's wait. Let's see if she arrives. If she doesn't, please call. And so the Palmers thought the defendant was also coming to dinner, not just Susan. Susan's mother testified that she forgot to tell them that he would be unable to come.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So nothing there. But basically, because I think I got a little confusing. So he's trying to find Susan. He can't find Susan. Susan and the kids are going to have dinner with his brother and sister-in-law. So he calls them and is like, hey, is Susan there? No, she's not here. Okay, well, let's wait 30 minutes until probably when she was supposed to arrive, or maybe 30 minutes would definitely be a sign that something was wrong. He gives the number probably at the hotel where he is at. Susan forgets to let everybody know that he's not going to be coming to dinner, and then she never shows up with the kids, okay? So this is kind of like the timeline here. Then, when she doesn't show up at 5:43, Mr. Hendricks calls the next door neighbor. He talks to Karen Kramer, asking her to go ring the front doorbell. He explained that he'd been trying to reach her. He believed the phone was out of order. So she rings the bell. No one answers the phone or answers the door. At 6:15, Nathan calls the defendant back, reporting that Susan has not arrived for dinner. So now he's like, well, not to worry. She's probably running some errands. But at this point, everyone's worried.
Well, yeah, and he was too.
Right. But it's no big deal. She's probably running errands.
That didn't make sense.
Exactly.
Back then, they also had people that had copies of your house key to check on each other.
Yeah. Well, so Nathan calls other relatives to see if anyone had seen Susan. At 9 p.m., he and his brother-in-law, Gerald Buchanan, went to look for her. So no one's seen him all day. No one has seen Susan. No one has seen the kids. Supposedly, he's trying to reach them, which we see from the phone records that he was indeed calling. But he's acting concerned, and then he's acting like it's no big deal.
So this would be on a Tuesday. Did they not go to school, some of them? Or were they home?
A good thing. I mean, it's November. They should have been in school.
Or December.
It's November. Okay. Yeah.
He called the in-laws to see if they had gotten there.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he's setting up another an alarm. Because if best friend is going to your house to eat, I'm not going to call you. Did best friend get there? You people don't call. Oh, are they there?
True.
Well, it was in the 80s, though.
I know, but still, if you go to eat, I mean, if you were going to eat, I'm not going to call. Did she go there?
Yeah,
I think he's setting up the alarm again for he's been looking. He doesn't know. I mean, I don't know. It just sounds like
find the bodies.
Let someone else.
He started calling about 3:00 supposedly, and they were supposed to have dinner, 5 or 6, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's suspect.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely adding up.
Because you're like, can't reach them for a couple of hours. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or are we just cold?
And, well, he didn't want to call at night because he might wake them up. I know when my kids are little and my husband works, he's calling.
Yeah.
Them kids are not going to wake up because the phone rang once or twice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're in the bedrooms.
Yeah.
So, oh, I didn't call because I was afraid they're going to wake up. No.
That's a good point.
I mean, there's another. Why didn't call? Because, no.
So he called the Kramer's residence again at 6:31. Karen said, I wasn't able to get anybody. No one came to the door. So at his request, she tried to reach Susan again. She called him back. Nope, I couldn't get her a hold of him. He reassured her, but then he asked for the police department's telephone number. So he's getting nervous that he can't get a hold of his family. So he telephoned the police department, stating that he'd been unable to reach his wife, feared that she might have been involved in an automobile accident. So the police department referred him to the state police. The state police said there's been no accidents. So now he said, I'm worried. So he started home at 7 p.m. or 7:10, telling the hotel clerk that an emergency situation had developed. At 9, so he's on his way back, he called the Kramer residence again, and he told them, I should get there around 11 p.m.
Didn't the police, though, run the route that he told her that she should have been on going to the dinner?
I don't know, maybe.
I think that was in the podcast. The police ran where she might have driven to see if there was an accident not reported yet.
Yeah, I could see that.
I think so.
I could see that. So Nathan and Gerald, they get to the house at 10:30 p.m. Officer Michael Hibbins and Detective Michael O'Brien arrived at the home a short time later. They tried the screen door at the back of the house. The door was closed, but not locked, which is important. He walked into the porch, and he entered with O'Brien through the sliding glass patio door, again shut but not locked, while Palmer and Buchanan waited outside. There they discovered the bodies of the three children, Hibbins did, and then O'Brien discovered Susan's body. The officers touched only the stairway light switch and then the light switch in the children's room. Now, outside, O'Brien told Buchanan and Palmer that Susan and the children were dead. Buchanan asked if maybe there had been a gas leak, like how would they be dead? O'Brien said no. All of the doors to the upstairs rooms were open, a chest of drawers was tipped forward in a bedroom adjacent to the girls' bedroom, drawers were pulled out, and areas of the house were disordered, but the garage had been undisturbed. Now, that bothers me, because it is real easy to tell a staged burglary scene. So I'm not sure how things are here, but drawers, when they're pulled out, if there's a burglary, they usually start from the bottom because they're not going to take the time to close them.
I saw that on a show not too long ago. They start at the bottom.
Yep. And then there's no reason really to tip over the girl's dresser.
Why would you go through the little girl's dressers anyway?
You're going to look in the garage for tools. You're going to look in the master bedroom for jewelry. You're going to open the drawers to go through quick, see if there's any money stashed away. You're going to tip things in there. You're not going to tip things in the little girl's room if it's a burglary. Mm-hmm. So what happens, people that are framing, you know, a whole burglary situation when they're the ones that did it, they'll just tip over stuff not thinking how a burglar's going to think. So they're thinking right off the bat, this is staged, okay? Especially the garage was undisturbed. So then Mr. Hendricks, he arrives and about 11:30, and Detective Charles Crow asked John Kramer if there was a private place where he and another detective could talk to Mr. Hendricks. So they suggested the master bedroom. At the time, Crow knew that the children and Susan were dead, and that Mr. Hendricks had returned from Wisconsin, so he interviewed the defendant from 11:30 to 12:40 p.m. According to Crow, Mr. Hendricks told him that he left home on Monday at about midnight.
So another three different times.
Yeah, but he supposedly left at 10:40 or 10:50. So he's not getting his story straight.
Oh, two times.
He said he left at midnight. For business, it was normal for him to leave on business trips at night since he usually worked through the night once every 7 to 10 days. He said normally he left between 2 or 3 a.m. and flew. However, he left earlier this time because he was driving. He said that when he left, the victims were in bed. So Crow said, What about locking the doors? Did you lock the doors? The defendant said, I think I remember latching the back patio door. The front door was locked. I think it was locked. I always check it. So then he said he stopped at a local restaurant for coffee, and then he stopped another time to change his clothes.
Hold on a second. So he left. Let's just say he did leave it. No, sorry. Coming back, it took him about 4 hours to get back. He didn't arrive into that town until it was either seven,
mm-hmm.
somewhere around seven.
Mm-hmm.
Why did it take so long? Taking that long?
And especially when he said that he stopped three times, and each time is only 15 yeah. minutes. So that would only add 4 hours or 45 minutes to his time. So yeah. the only thing I could think of is he's speeding to get back to the house, and it cut the time down big time.
That's a lot of big time. Or he didn't leave.
So he always left at night.
Mm-hmm.
So he would get to his destination during the day to make the sales.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And he did have a plane. So they're like, well, why didn't you take the plane? Well, he said, because I only take the plane into areas where I don't have a lot of stops that are like far apart.
Gotcha.
So he would take his plane into big cities because he could land, and then all the stops were in walking distance. But if it was a more rural area, he would then drive because he would have longer drives.
And didn't the secretary confirm that?
Mm-hmm. The secretary confirmed that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So then they search his automobile, his business, his airplane hangar. And they asked the defendant whether he had any hatchets or knives in the house.
Oh.
He said that he had an old axe in the garage and he did not have any hunting knives. Defendant agreed to go to the police station for further questionings. They take him there. And then they arrived at the station at 1 a.m. He wasn't handcuffed. He wasn't searched. They left him alone with a cup of coffee until 2:35, which is a very common tactic. They want to wear him down, make him nervous. He said that they were happily married, that they had discussed adopting a boy an hour before he left on November 7th. So he said she returned from the shower at approximately 10:45, which is not true. She returned home at 10:30. They did the drive. They did the drive.
Well, no, I mean, he's saying approximately 10:45.
15 minutes to me is not approximate.
But you got people like me that don't pay attention to stuff like that. You do the best you
but
can.
But earlier he said 10:30.
Or answers.
Like he's changing his story.
Okay.
He said earlier she got there at 10:30. Now he's saying 10:45.
Okay.
I think he's trying to buy some time. I think he's trying to mess with the timeline a little bit. But
and the time of death.
Exactly. Yeah. Then around midnight, he got out of bed, embraced, kissed Susan, who was awake, entered the children's bedrooms, kissed them while they were sleeping. He does not specifically remember checking the doors, but he did say it was his habit to check them and make sure the locks were in place and that a wooden security bar, which he had personally made, was down on the patio door, mm-hmm. which is very common. I've seen those in anybody yeah. that have the slide doors. The garage door had an automatic opening device, and it could not be opened manually. He had one of the garage door openers in his car. Susan had the other. He then left through the garage door, and he said that Susan would not have opened the door to a stranger. So he said he couldn't think of anyone that would want to harm them. The only items of value in the house were a microwave and perhaps a couple $100s. His axe was an old red-handled one. The police did not discover any physical evidence linking him to the offense. He said that it was possible during his trial testimony, when he was going over the statements that he gave the detective, that he left at 11, not midnight, and that he did not talk to Susan for an hour before leaving.
Yeah,
another change.
Story.
Yep.
This really reminds me of the Peterson one.
Mm-hmm. Now, the axe is important because that's how the victims were killed, was with an axe.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Was there blood on the one that he had?
I don't know. It may be in the these trial documents. I'm not sure. But on November 9th at 5, he talked to the media. During the interview, the reporter asked the defendant whether anything was missing from the house. And he said, well, I've not been in the house yet, but they said that some things looked as if they had been taken. Now, a lot of people use this to point to his guilt. Like, how would you know anything was taken? But I could see the family saying, like, if they heard that some things were taken, I could 100% see the family telling him that. So that doesn't bother me at all. So the police officers, the coroner's office, though, they all denied telling anyone that anything was taken.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time the coroner or officers lied.
Exactly. So the defense told, well, or that they were mistaken. Mm-hmm. So the defense brought up Nathan, his brother-in-law, and he stated that O'Brien, one of the police officers, had indeed said that it looked like the house had been ransacked. But he did admit that he did not recall this part of the conversation. So it just, to me, this is stuff that you can't take into consideration. You know, you've got him saying, well, he did tell me that it looked like the house had been ransacked. But then later he's like, well, I don't remember that conversation specifically.
Can't take it seriously.
Yeah. And I could see the cop telling him it looks like the house was ransacked.
Yeah.
So everybody's like, I didn't say it. Well, I don't remember it. So none of this really matters to me. But they did introduce testimony about the investigation and the analysis of the house. No blood stains were found on the defendant. None were found on his clothing or vehicles. Which is interesting because if you're leaving after killing, a lot of times they wash in haste and they miss blood. So no fingerprints were found on the red-handled axe, which was at the scene, or the knife, which were found with their blades aligned at the foot of the bed in which Grace and Benjamin had been killed.
Yeah, if you had a bloody scene like that with an axe, you'd have blood on you somewhere in your car.
Well, yeah, somewhere. But didn't he have 9 hours or 12 hours to
clean up the scene?
That? I mean, you could have wore plastic.
That's a lot, like, though, killing kids and the mother. And cleaning up a lot.
The lack of blood doesn't sway me to his innocence. It's intriguing, but I find it weird. So you go, so you're killing people with an axe and a knife, and then you set them on the edge of the bed?
Yeah.
That's weird.
And they had separate, did they have separate
beds?
Well, yeah. Each of them had an item
at
the foot of the bed. One had an axe, one had a knife.
So the red-handled axe or knife, they were found with their blades aligned at the foot of the bed in which Grace and Benjamin had been killed. It's weird.
Creepy and crappy.
But yeah, what about also the other girl? Weird is there were no prints or stains on their handles because they had been thoroughly cleaned. Mm-hmm. Not that someone was wearing gloves. Mm-hmm. That the blood and everything had been cleaned. That's getting rid of the fingerprints.
Well, why wouldn't you thoroughly clean the whole thing then and then hide the axe or take it with you and dump it?
Shock value, maybe?
It's just weird. It's a weird deal. I'm trying to think. Okay, can y'all think of any crimes where the killer leaves the knife neatly at the foot of the bed or the axe? I'm trying to think of...
Did Bundy do stuff like that? Leave them neatly? No.
No, because he would kill him out in the forest.
I feel like there is one, but...
Tommy Lynn Sells. I'm trying to think of him, because his favorite weapon were knives. And typically, he just used the knife that was in the kitchen and then dropped it right after he was done. There was no setting it anywhere. He would do his work, drop the knife, and out he would go.
I feel like there is.
To me, it sounded like it was planned. Because you take the time to kill him, you take the time to lay it out. There's your, like, it was almost, I don't know. I think it was planned. Someone didn't just run in there and murder them.
Do you see this? You have to talk
to it. Yeah, because people are going to be listening to the podcast and be like, what?
Huh? What?
Okay, so here's what, again, we go back to the psychology. Mm-hmm. What is interesting to me is I could see the killer wiping his prints off, 100%. Right. Mm-hmm. But I don't see the killer laying them on the bed. What it points to is a person who owns those items and isn't going to just throw them on the ground because they own them. And I know it sounds weird, but people prize their possessions. And to me, it's more of an owner behavior versus someone who could care less where that axe is, where that knife is. They just went in to kill an entire family, which is weird on its own. And they would have just dropped the weapons wherever. I don't see them doing that.
Planned. I think someone cared about them because they laid things out almost like leaving a flower or a, I think it was planned because if it was a frenzy, like the Manson people, they just came in, chopped up, killed, blah, 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 left like this to me. So if you randomly pick a house, you don't know if the man's coming home. So you're going to be in a hurry for everything.
Yep.
Whoever did it knew someone wasn't coming home.
And not only that,
had time to do whatever.
But you're just
going to
go around finding weapons? No, you're going to go straight to the kitchen where you know knives are. You're not going to go in the garage to try to find an axe unless you can't find an appropriate weapon in the kitchen.
That's but it doesn't mean it was an owner, though. It could mean somebody in his business. You know, when he started his business, cleanliness, he was.
That's what
sterile,
I was just thinking.
I mean,
sterile OCD.
Yeah, laying them. Yeah, but laying them down is weird. But it doesn't. I think he would be very
clean.
But I'm
yeah,
also
clean.
Curious. That's what I was thinking. How was he? Was
exactly.
That his MO? Was he like? I don't want to keep using the word OCD, but a lot of people feel that, you know, it's very ritualistic and.
You have to clean.
Yeah, clean and then lay things out a certain way. Have everything.
That's
a certain
interesting.
Way.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm not, I don't want to stereotype, but he was a smart individual. He was an inventor. He had a patent on his product.
A sterile.
And they tend toward certain orders, certain rituals, creatives like that. I mean, I've seen it over and over.
Yeah.
Did you have something else?
No, that was it.
Okay. So thoroughly cleaned, very little blood was found in the house, which is interesting. You know, obviously some in the kids' bedroom. The southwest bedroom, the children's room, showed evidence, of course, of blood splatter on the walls. A butcher knife was missing from the kitchen block on the kitchen counter. It was upright and aligned with the edge of the cabinet. So it was carefully taken out. It wasn't grabbed fast. Okay. Some of the rooms in the house appeared to have been ransacked, but there were no pry marks or scrapes on the frame of the sliding glass door at the rear of the house and no indication that it had been compromised. The front door was locked. None of the windows, doors, or locks showed signs of forced entry. Only the sliding glass door was unlocked. They tested the house with luminol, and in the southwest bedroom, the south wall around and inside the closet, the face of the dresser, the mirror located on the north wall, the beds and the floor reacted. A few bluish drops reacted in the hallway, bathroom, on the vanity. A smear also reacted on the vanity by the sink. The entire bottom of the tub reacted in a 2 to 3 inch spot at the back of the tub, approximately 5 feet from the floor, reacted. I think he washed up after.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or someone.
Someone.
The master bedroom, the bed reacted. The handles of the dresser also reacted. And they said, though, that luminol can react with copper or carbon alloys on the handles. And so that could have been what was happening. And it can also interact with, like, cascade, bleach, and other cleaning items. And so the reason that's important is they're like, well, did the tub react because of cleaning products or did the tub react because of blood? So that's where, you know, there could be some dispute there so that he could not conclude whether the tub or shower in the hallway bathroom near the children's bedroom was the was because of the presence of blood or that it was the presence of cleaning products. But the blood was not spread throughout the rest of the house. So that's important to me. Because if we have a killer who has just, you know,
yeah,
and there's blood everywhere, if he did not go to the bathroom and wash up, there would have been blood throughout wherever he walked to get out of the house.
He could have killed him in the bathtub. He could have given him something to make him either woozy or knock him out. One by one, get him, kill him in the bath because it's contained.
Yeah.
Because if you're killed by an axe, it's going to be a bloody scene.
I don't know, there was blood splattered.
Yeah, we know that they were killed in the children's room and that she was killed in the master, but the only blood was from those rooms to that bathroom and in that bathroom. So I believe that the killer immediately went into the bathroom and began cleaning up, is what I believe. Mm-hmm. Especially if you have blood on the
Was there tons vanity. Of blood on the sheets and the bed she was laying in, like blood-soaked mattress like mm-hmm. that?
And there was cast off.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a bloody mess.
But the weapons. I just can't keep thinking about the weapons. If he did it, he was leaving. He would have dumped them.
And there would have been something in his vehicle, too. That's a lot of blood.
That's where the psychology comes in. That's what I was saying. I don't think he would have, because they were his possessions.
He kept trying to make his alibi.
But he wiped off everything on the axe and the knife. So I think taking a chance that there are no fingerprints after he does that, I mean, it's thoroughly cleaned. They can't find any blood on it. I think, again, it was his possessions, and he would be more inclined to clean them and leave them there versus throwing them away. Hmm. But, I mean, you know, if we're reading this guy right, you know, we may not, and he may have taken them if he didn't do it. But it just, that's a very interesting thing to me to do, because again, if you're a stranger on stranger attacker, you're just going to drop them whenever you're done. You're not going to wipe them off. You're going to wear probably gloves. You're not.
Someone cared
about them. Or you're going to take them with you.
Someone cared about them. Mm-hmm. I think
someone cared about him that killed him is what best friend said, for those of you that can't hear her. Okay, so then they confirmed the presence of human blood on the vanity in the hallway bathroom, on a headboard spindle in the master bathroom, and then in 17 locations in the southwest bedroom. Extensive amounts of blood were found on the beds and the bed clothing, except for the head of the axe, blade of the butcher knife, victim's sleeping garments, bed, and the bed clothing. No blood was found in the rest of the house. None. At all. All of the victims had type A blood.
That's interesting.
Yep. Yeah. And that was found on the axe and the blade of the butcher knife. There was also a cut or a tear 22 inches from the top edge of the bedspread in the master bedroom, which was consistent with being caused by an axe. Mm-hmm. However, the state's expert could not positively determine what instrument caused the V-shaped cut or tear and several small defects near the top edge of the spread near the edge of the sheet. They agreed that a figure portrayed in a photograph appeared to be a matchstick and remembered examining a sliver of wood on the stairs leading to the second floor, but he didn't collect it. There were no tobacco products or ashtrays in the house, but there was a fireplace. So the reason that's important is they're saying, well, they didn't smoke, so it had to have been someone that smokes, that matchstick sliver was at the crime scene. And they're like, no, it could just simply be they have a fireplace.
Right.
And that's how the match sliver got up there. So, you know, they're trying to start building their case. And so I think we're going to finish with just a few more points. Because, again, this is going to be a two-parter. I cannot believe this. Like, we're going to have like a main season of what should be a mini season. Here we are, two parts, every single one of them. Okay, so based on the blood splatter analysis, the assailant stood between the children's beds at the time of the attack. So picture, you got the twin beds, they're 22 inches apart, the killer's between the two beds when he attacked Grace and Benjamin. He noted minimal blood on the ceiling. However, he did find splatters on and around the room, except in an area where the person would block.
Yeah.
Okay. And then he also found blood splatter inside a shoe wedged under one of the pulled out drawers, meaning they were killed first and then the drawers were pulled out.
Well, that makes sense because of the blood. Mm-hmm. Get all over the fingerprints.
And then there weren't any splatters on the clothing that were in the drawers either. So they know, but the face was splattered with it of the drawers. So they were definitely open post-attack. So they know that the assailant would have been splattered with blood when he searched the room after the attack. There was a significant amount of dried blood on the weapons. He did not have an opinion on the order of death. He didn't know. But he admitted that cast-offs would have been found in the master bedroom had the axe been bloody when Susan was attacked. So Dodwell stated that a blanket had been pulled over her face and head prior to the attack. Why'd she say,
It's always a family member.
Yeah.
Yep.
When they cover the face.
Mm-hmm. Family member, loved ones.
So wouldn't that stop you from getting blood all over you?
Yeah.
If you covered them up and then...
Yeah. But are y'all aware of any case where a family member did it and they weren't... Are y'all aware of any case where they were covered... And it wasn't a family member?
No. I'm not.
But I'm not aware of any case where children and a mother or father were killed when it wasn't one of the parents that did it.
Yeah.
But I'm still on the fence with him, honestly.
I am. Tommy Lynn Sells. He killed the little boy and a mother did not do it.
I remember that case.
And the cops are like, it had to be you because they had never heard of a case where it wasn't someone from inside the family who killed the family member.
I mean the whole family.
Well, that was her whole family. But
well, you know what I mean. There's predators that kill children and rape children, but for a whole family to be wiped out. What was that guy's name? They did a bust of him.
That was my very first case where I got interested in true crime.
What was his name?
Oh, I can't use my phone. It's one of our episodes, but...
He laid all the family down in the living room.
It was one of our very first. It's a Family Annihilators series.
Okay. And he was a deacon of the church, the whole thing, and they found him with John Walsh.
But
and
he covered every one of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he couldn't, the mother, because she was too... heavy to get down to the rest of the family. Yeah. So he left her where she was. Yeah.
John.
I'll find it.
Okay. Look it up because it's bothering me.
I'm not sure, but I see what you're saying. So you have a parent along with the children that are killed. I cannot think of any case where it's not a family annihilator, except, I have heard of cases where the cartels or things like that where they have killed the entire families.
Oh, yeah.
But there's typically a connection to the cartels. Mm-hmm. It's not just randomly they're dead.
Yeah, a parent killing the whole family.
I'm going to go with
that. I'm on the fence, though. There's just not enough evidence.
Well, who wants?
But statistically, he has to be probably guilty. I mean, because again, back to the family, all the family wiped out. Then covering her face, that's usually a...
So what bothers me is if it wasn't for his timeline changing, that bothers me. Why do you keep changing your timeline? Did you leave at 11? Did you leave at 10:50? Did you leave at midnight? I could say, like if he said I left between 10:50 and 11, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But why do you keep harping on this midnight deal? And why do you tell your secretary for the first time ever that you're going to leave at midnight and then you don't? Why do you say that you visited with your wife for an hour about adopting a boy that late at night? And then later you say, we didn't visit for an hour. I left at 11 something. Like he keeps changing his story. So that bothers me. And covering the face.
Yes. But statistically, it should be him.
And the whole sales thing. I feel like all of that, he was...
An alibi.
Crappy, setting up his alibi.
Because he was a good salesman.
You don't have... If you're a good salesman, you have your stuff with you.
Well, and then you have a lie, because he did have his stuff, but he lied to the potential customers telling them that he didn't have his product when he did.
He was there to set an alibi. Yeah.
I agree. If he had gone on this trip to sell his products, he would have brought those products in. He did have them, and yet he lied and said he didn't. Yeah, that bothers me.
You know, in some cases, I never pay that much attention to timeline stories, because I know for myself, if someone said, well, when did this happen? I could have all sorts of times, because I'm not sure to go about, maybe between 2 and 3, maybe.
I ask you what time you leave for work, best friend. You always know. I left 5 o'clock. I got up at 4:30.
Well, that's repetition.
That's what I'm saying. He knows when he left.
Yeah.
I could see.
You know when it's your everyday routine. Mm-hmm. You know when you left.
I could see a 5 to 10 minute, even a 30 minute discrepancy, but an hour.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
That's huge.
Well, I'm still on the fence, so hopefully.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the case, Elena?
I jumped over that.
So what are you thinking for right now with what we've discussed so far? Where are you at?
Guilty.
Yeah. I'm.
You too.
I think he's guilty.
However, I will say that your tone through the case definitely has me leaning towards guilty.
You know,
if it had been more neutral.
That's a good point. That's a good point. It's hard for me to fake it. I think the dude's guilty. But the ending is quite shocking, actually.
Yep.
But yes. Now, did you find the guy's name? John?
No, I can't get to all of our seasons.
Just do serial killer John left his family on the floor.
I'm not writing a book to Google.
On the floor. John.
It was in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
And the mother-in-law.
And remember, they did the bust of his face, John Walsh, in a forensic sculptress.
I will say one thing. That guy's good looking from here. Now, I don't have a magnifying glass, but he may have killed them, won a new life. He has an airplane. He's successful. He might have been tired of the old family thing. And I mean,
you'll have to find out tomorrow in part two.
Okay. Yeah. All right, guys.
What
well,
was his name?
I don't want to forget our tagline like I have for the every part two. Again, I'm surprised. I didn't know this was going to be
we
a
go
part
out
two.
Of order?
No.
Oh.
Sister.
Be rude.
No.
That's mine. That's mine.
Be smart.
I don't even need to say mine. You knew I wanted to say it first.
And I did it out of order. I had already had it planned before, like literally right before you said, can we do it out of order?
She's feeling a little salty. Feeling a little salty.
Okay, be smart. Be rude, sister.
Don't be a victim.
Bye.
Bye. Outline of a Murder is a Mr. Joseph production. What do you think, Joseph?